In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
If you want to know why Trump won the 2024 election, and not just the Electoral College, but the popular vote as well, it's because he followed the old adage, politics is a game of addition. Throughout his campaign, he was adding allies. RFK Jr. is the prime example of that. Tulsi Gabbard, Vivek Ramaswamy, Elon Musk, Joe Rogan. Meanwhile, Kamala was turning away people, repulsively telling Christians they weren't welcome at her rallies. But while his win was certainly exciting and a huge relief and giving real hope for the future of this country, if there's one lesson I hope people learn, it's to not sabotage yourself. As a voter, stop stabbing yourself in the back, which ought to be another old adage in politics. 9% of conservatives voted for Kamala. Nearly 1 in 10 conservatives? Really? How on earth can you call yourself a conservative and vote for Kamala, the most openly anti-conservative candidate of all time? Evangelicals voted overwhelmingly for Trump, 79%, but 19% went for Kamala. 1 in 5 evangelical voters voted for Kamala? Seriously? What part of evangelical Christianity exactly did Kamala stand for? But here's the thing, everyone has got to start voting down ballot for the candidates that will support your presidential candidate. Trump won the popular vote by millions of votes. He won the Electoral College overwhelmingly. The Republicans won both the House and the Senate, but they should have won both of those by much more. For heaven's sakes, vote down ballot, because while it's great and there's lots of euphoria right now among conservatives about Trump's agenda and the mandate that his big win brings with it, if there's one thing that's going to stand in his way, it will be Congress. Imagine how much faster and how much more of that agenda could be implemented if Trump had a 30-seat majority in the House and another 3 or 4 Senate seats. You can absolutely bet that the Democrats are already scheming how they will retake Congress and start Trump's third impeachment. Stopping that depends on Trump's success, and that depends on this Congress. So you as a voter definitely need to be engaged to hold them accountable, because holding government accountable is the new era. Welcome to it. James Herson is an international business attorney, news analyst, cultural commentator, and social media scholar, and he is also the New York Times bestselling author of Tales from the Left Coast, True Stories of Hollywood Stars and Their Outrageous Politics. James, thanks for joining us today as we look back at the election and look down the road at what's next.
Well, it's great to be with you, Mark, and we're just in a period of joy and gratitude.
Yes.
The answered prayers.
Oh,
because,
absolutely.
Because we've seen a series of miracles, and they continue. I really think that the prayer warriors across this country, I mean, in addition, of course, to people that did the hard work of campaigning,
sure,
and of course, our great candidate and now president-elect, I think all of that contributed to something that is just, anyone who predicted it before it happened would have been laughed out of the room.
Yeah.
And so it's miraculous.
Well, sure, it absolutely is. And, you know, since you kind of start there with faith, one of the big fears going in, certainly of mine, was that about a month before the election, a study found that up to 70 million Christians might sit out the 2024 election and not vote. I haven't seen a similar study that shows exactly how many of those 70 million did in fact show up, but we won whether or not they did. I'm a Christian. I know you're a Christian. That was really shocking to me as a Christian that other Christians were considering not voting, especially given the state of the country and how anti-Christian it had become over the last 4 years. It just completely boggled my mind why anyone would choose to sit that out and just not and just let that continue, especially Christians.
Well, I think not everyone who self-identifies with the name Christian is actually a Christian.
Yeah.
I mean, we have all kinds of denominations who have basically given up on doctrinal moral issues and are involved with a false Christianity. And I think that's part of the reason that we hear stats like that. I think I was gratified. One, in the exit polls, I think Trump won the Catholic vote, I think in great part because of his high standing with Hispanics. The most shocking thing, of course, is that Trump won Hispanic males.
Yes.
And, you know, this thing with, right toward the end of the campaign, Kamala and her campaign, they were trying to go after men. And who did they trot out to go after men? Barack Obama, the former president. So-called males for Kamala who were, you know, just not macho. And the fact is that men were sent messaging by the regime and by the media and by the left-wing institutions that they should be ashamed of their natural masculinity.
Right.
That somehow is toxic and men should be subservient. They should be these beta males and metrosexuals. And then they wonder why African-American men, Hispanic men, Caucasian men, Jewish men would all basically come out in overwhelming numbers. And that, so, I mean, that's a significant story,
yes.
But there's so many. I mean, the fact is we have to stand back and see we have an election where a Republican candidate won the popular vote, the electoral vote, and basically all three branches of government, the trifecta. In the state of California, which I live in, a very blue state, about 35% of the counties flipped. We had a state referendum that would roll back some of the Soros criminal law that Kamala had backed.
Yep.
And it passed 3-1. And in Los Angeles and Alameda County, they threw out Soros-backed fake DAs. And I say fake because these are people who got in for saying we're not going to prosecute. And so urban California crime rates went just absolutely crazy to the point where big retailers shut down their businesses and moved out of San Francisco and Los Angeles. And so we're seeing a proper backlash to basically woke policies wherever they may lie, whether we're talking about internationally, foreign policy, we're talking about domestic policy, we're talking about border policy. Mm-hmm. It's just and parents and their children dealing with the curriculum at school. It was just everywhere.
Yes.
And we expected this red wave years ago, but I think it just came providentially.
Yes. Well, you know, I really think you almost needed to see the opposite side first. And I think, you know, seeing what Kamala has done and Biden did to the country, especially all of the attacks on Christians, the attacks on parents, the attack on girls in sports and all the rest. I think people needed to see that in order to make that switch to Trump. And boy, I tell you, him winning the popular vote, that had to be one of the biggest shocks of the election. It would so stun the left, even Antifa didn't riot in Portland. So there you go. All right, it is time for a break. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with James Herson. Coming up, we'll be talking about Trump's free speech blueprint. And welcome back. Continuing now with our guest, James Herson. He is a news analyst, cultural commentator, and best-selling author. And you can find all of his latest articles with his unique perspective through the lens of a moral universe at jamesherson.com. That's James, H-I-R-S-E-N.com. And in case you missed that, we'll have it on our show notes on today's show page on iSpireRadio.com, which is 14-46. So, James, speaking of articles, we really wanted to have you on to talk about your latest one, Trump's Free Speech Blueprint. You're not just an author and a commentator, but you're an attorney and former law professor. So this really taps into several of your strengths. I mean, during this election season, we had government officials actively calling for censorship and getting rid of free speech, certainly finding some ways to clamp down on the First Amendment. I mean, how insane is that? The government's job is to protect our rights, all of them, but especially our First Amendment rights, because without the ability to speak freely and to question our government and hold them accountable, it seems to me that this American experiment would be at an end.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was like the sleeper issue. You know, we talked about some of the other issues that were front and center. Obviously, people were upset about the border, about the economy. They were upset about safety and crime. But everyone who uses the social media, everyone who knows someone who had speech censored, know someone who was persecuted for their beliefs, it was underneath, and it helped Trump create this coalition. I mean, it convinced, I think, to a great extent, Elon Musk, who turned out to be invaluable
to the president's
success. Obviously, a great advocate of free speech, because his acquisition of Twitter, now turned to X, yielded the Twitter files, which we discovered that is a blatant violation of the First Amendment. When government is involved, that's when the First Amendment really kicks in with regard to the speech clause. And we found out that government was working with Twitter. We don't know the exact extent, but we know it was happening. We know that the Biden administration was setting up basically a ministry of truth. Mm-hmm. We know that these terms, Orwellian terms, misinformation and disinformation, were used to classify speech in such a way that either it was deplatformed or demonetized or shadow banned, which is, by the way, all of these things are still going on, but a lot of people don't realize that Donald Trump has made that a central issue. He's talked about it at his rallies. He put up a video on it. And the reason that he got, I mentioned Elon Musk, Joe Rogan, who, I mean, basically a lot of politicians never heard of Joe Rogan being the most powerful voice in the media, period. Joe Rogan came online mostly because of free speech. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., our next HHS secretary, came online.
Yep.
Tulsi Gabbard, who will be the director of National Intelligence, came online and came together because we witnessed and experienced not only the rhetoric, which you mentioned, I mean, the idea that members of a political party would go out and advocate free expression being violated just as a normal part of life. We're talking about something that's fundamental and indispensable to any representative democracy, mm-hmm. our being a representative democracy, a.k.a. a republic. And, you know, this is what Trump said, you know, his usual blunt style. He said, if we don't have free speech, we don't have a free country.
That's right.
And, of course, he's right. Mm-hmm. And then what's he going to do? Well, these are really positive steps towards restoration of our constitutional norms. He's going to sign an executive order, I suspect, be one of the earliest ones he signs. It's going to ban any part of the bureaucracy, any federal department, for colluding with any outside organization. That includes big tech, to censor speech of American citizens. Then he's going to prevent money from being used to label any speech as those two Orwellian terms that I talked about.
And what I also like about that is he's going after the universities that are doing studies on how to clamp down on free speech. I love that too.
That's exactly right. You know, the academic world has abandoned the idea of free expression. and why should we fund them? So that's part of it, stopping funding of all of these nonprofits, including colleges and universities, and then limiting the immunity of the tech companies and more, you know. And so this is, it's just a wonderful common sense approach to bringing back what we've always treasured in our country. You know, we've always, but what in the world are people going out and fighting and dying for? And that was our statement. You know, I may not agree with you, but I'll fight to the death for your right to say it. We live in a country where free speech was so important that there's a landmark Supreme Court decision. And this is how important it was. A decision that disturbed people, because when I grew up in Chicago, in a suburb to the north of Chicago, is Skokie, Illinois. And at the time of this case, there were survivors of concentration camps with the numbers tattooed on their arms living in Skokie. Well, real Nazis, not the fake Nazis that they're always screaming about. They wanted to have a march through Skokie. And of course, the people were so upset, they tried to prevent it. But the United States Supreme Court said, free speech is so important that we're going to let Nazis march. And that's offensive. It's offensive to me, and it's offensive to those people. But when it comes to speech, we would bend over backwards as Americans. The ACLU used to be a group that believed in civil liberties and free speech. They don't anymore.
No.
But we, you know, obviously, people talk about, well, I'm an absolute free speech. There's not absolutes, because you can't slander people. You can't make false statements that harm people's reputations, their privacy. You can't, as the classic line was, yell fire in a crowded theater. You incite people. But if you're expressing legitimate points of view, and all of these taboo subjects that we live through, particularly through the pandemic, people had questions about the 2020 election, and no one could talk about it.
Yeah, well,
and I know very well some of these anchors, they got the word from their producers to stop.
Yeah.
If they were talking about questions about the 2020 election, questions about...
Oh, yeah, or about the Hunter laptop and COVID and all the rest. I mean, it's insane to think that you can somehow gain trust by silencing others. That's just not how trust works. Okay, it is time for a break. Everyone stay with us. We'll wrap up with James Hurston after this. We are wrapping things up with James Hurston. He is a news analyst, cultural commentator, business attorney, and New York Times bestselling author. His website is simply jameshurston.com. Hurston is H-I-R-S-E-N, jameshurston.com. And coming up, we're going to be talking with Robert Popper from Judicial Watch about their lawsuit against Oregon for refusing to clean up their voter rolls, so stick around for that. And James, you know, during the break, we just started talking about Matt Gaetz, because I really think that this future cabinet that is shaping up, I think this could be perhaps one of the most exciting cabinets I ever remember.
Oh, absolutely. It is. And that's the word. It's exciting. It's entertaining. And I have to say, watching the Democrats clutch their pearls and get all emotional about these people, particularly Pete Hegseth and Matt Gaetz, it's unreal. You know, here's Pete Hegseth. Oh, he's a Fox News host. Happens to be one that went to Princeton and Harvard, has two Bronze Stars, actually held a gun, not like Tim Walz, actually was in combat. And so he understands exactly the costs of war, not like these warmonger people that just want to push us into every kind of foreign war. And then Matt Gaetz, here you put yourself in President Trump's shoes. He sees Matt Gaetz as somebody who's smart, who's honest, who's outspoken, and he can trust. Matt Gaetz is loyal. After Trump experienced Jeff Sessions and Bill Barr, and then had to go through this horrid situation with a special counsel, basically investigating fictions that were set up by Hillary Clinton. He wants somebody rock solid, and he knows that he can do a recess appointment if they don't confirm him.
Well, and what I thought was really telling there with Matt Gaetz, and one of the things I like about him being there, even though I don't know a lot about his experience as an attorney, I love the fact that he went through some of the same abuse that Trump went through, because the DOJ were leaking all of this stuff that, well, he might be investigated for sex trafficking and some of these outrageous things. And so he knows what that's like. I think that's the perfect person to go in there and clean that all up.
Yeah, I mean, if you're the victim of an investigation where that went on for years and they didn't prosecute him because they didn't find anything. Mm-hmm. And it's very questionable, the origin of the investigation, especially since he's someone,
probably Russians.
You know, you talk about the taboo subjects. Yeah, which Matt Gaetz talked about the taboo subjects regularly and attacked his own, which is now why we're seeing some of these people on Fox attacking Matt Gaetz. Mm-hmm. But, I think they should approve him, and I don't know that they will, but my prayer is that President Trump will to use the recess appointment strategy and put him in there.
Yeah, if he has to.
And we need someone that's going to clean this up. I mean, when you see what the Department of Justice has become and the things that they've engaged in, their priorities are ridiculous. And they've been politicized, and there's no doubt about it. So you need someone that you know will not hold back, will not turn into a Jeff Sessions, who appeared to be a great pick at the time.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden was
just
a different
turned
person
to mush. Yeah. Well, looking at the whole Gaetz thing, you can really see how Trump is just, I mean, you can see his strategy mind really coming into effect here. On Sunday, when they announced the potential runners for the Senate Majority Leader, he demanded that the Republicans support recess appointments. And then 3 days later, he announces somebody that will probably require a recess appointment. But I thought it was really interesting because watching this unfold, I really think looking down the road, Congress is going to be probably the biggest roadblock to Trump's agenda. Because on November 13th, Wednesday, 12:14 p.m., Trump posted this Truth Social congratulating John Thune for being elected Senate Majority Leader. Thune promised, and all of the other prominent Republicans, they all promised to support President Trump's agenda. 3 hours, 10 minutes later, Trump releases a statement on Truth Social announcing Gaetz's nomination. So the Republican senators who had just promised to support Trump immediately criticized the pick. And according to one report, between 5 and 10 of them made a vote against Gaetz. So, I think Gaetz's appointment was a test for Senate Republicans to see if they really were behind Trump or just mouthing their supports, because it only took a few hours for the frauds to expose themselves.
No, of course. And, Lisa Murkowski and company are not going to be supporting all these picks. So it's just no matter what they say. And it wasn't anybody, I mean, at least not mine and most of the people right of center for John Thune to be elected. But all that being said, Trump is a master strategist, as you're noticing, and he plays 3D, 4D chess. And, he may have something in the back of his mind where he says, okay, you won't approve Matt Gaetz and he'll trot out Rudy Giuliani or somebody like that.
Really?
there's a strategy it's been used by other presidents, where they put out someone that they know is not going to get approved, and there's a weariness that sets in with the Senate, and the next one is softer, so they get someone approved. So I'm not sure, but I'd like to see Matt Gaetz in there.
Oh, I would too.
I love his picks. I don't have a single pick that bothers me. I worry about Marco Rubio a little bit, but I think President-elect Trump knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I do too, and I agree with you. I haven't seen a pick yet that I don't like. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock there with you, James. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Judicial Watch is a conservative but nonpartisan educational foundation which seeks to ensure that political and judicial officials do not abuse the powers entrusted to them by the American people. Judicial Watch fulfills its educational mission through litigation, investigations, and public outreach. They recently sued Oregon to make them clean up their voter rolls. And we are pleased to be talking to Bob Popper, a senior attorney who directs Judicial Watch's voting integrity efforts. Bob, it is great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, before we get to Oregon, because a lot of us have just been waiting for these kinds of suits, before we get there, talk to us about some of your work and success stories to clean up voter rolls in other states.
Well, we typically sue under the National Voter Registration Act. This is a federal law, and often known as the motor voter law, that requires states to clean up their voter rolls as part of a package deal, which is Bill Clinton's old law. You can sign up at the Motor Vehicles Department to register to vote, and states have to clean their voter rolls, make sure that people who moved out of state or died are taken off the rolls. We sue to enforce that part of the law. And in doing so, we go to states where they should have removed many more people under a provision requiring them to remove people who've moved out of state. And we take their own data on who they've removed, and we show it to them and say, how can this be? We went to New York City, and we said, how can it be that in 2 years you removed 22 people? Mm. I mean, people for having moved out of state. They got back to us. We actually settled a lawsuit with them, and they said that they were removing, to start with, 566,000 outdated registrations.
Wow.
Okay, there's no disenfranchisement here. These are people who were out of state.
Right.
They couldn't vote in New York anymore. Okay, we went to Pennsylvania, and we sent a couple of letters to counties and to the state. And in response to one of our letters, Allegheny County admitted that it removed 69,000 registrations that were outdated. We never had to sue them. We never did. But the state of Pennsylvania we sued, and they ultimately represented to a federal judge that in response to our letter and lawsuit, they removed 180,000 registrations that were out of date.
So when they go ahead and reply, like in that case, and say, hey, okay, we got this notice and we've gone ahead and removed them, why are they not doing that as a matter of course?
Well, you know, why indeed? The short answer is it costs money to police your voter rolls. You have to make an effort.
Yeah, but that's their job. I mean, what do they do between elections other than they should be maintaining the voter rolls?
Well, that's my view. That's our view. That's why we sue them. Look, I don't, you know, it is infuriating, but when we start a lawsuit, all we want to do is establish that, in fact, they have neglected this. Hmm. You know, and I won't say I don't care why they're in this situation. It's so common, and there are so many explanations, and they all tend to revolve around the same factors of lack of money, lack of desire. I mean, I once had a county inform me in writing, and I quote, we don't do NVRA.
Wow.
NVRA is National Voter Registration Act. Well, and I'm like, you do now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you had mentioned before we got going there that there's a war against the National Voter Registration Act. Is there some kind of ambiguity in that law that allows states to think that, oh, we don't really have to clean up our voter rolls, because you've mentioned a number of states here that simply refuse to do it. Well, how do they get away with that?
Well, I don't think there is such an ambiguity, which, you know, isn't worth a cup of coffee. But the United States Supreme Court doesn't think there's an ambiguity.
Yes, exactly.
Look, this law was passed in the Clinton era, and it was initially enforced by the likes of Janet Reno. And Janet Reno's Justice Department basically made war on the integrity provisions of this statute.
Hmm.
They loved the motor voter hat. They hated the other side of the compromise. They argued, for example, they used to argue that removal of people who may have moved is not mandatory. The states can choose to do that. They argued that states can't even start the process of removal, which, by the way, takes years. If you don't respond to the state and tell them you've moved, they have to send you a letter, ask if you're there, and then wait for two general federal elections. So that's as little as two and as many as 4 years. And then the registration is removed. The Reno Justice Department argued that states can't even start that process. They can't even send that letter to someone who hasn't voted for years.
Wow.
Now, the Supreme Court in 2018 tossed out both of these arguments. And to me, the real shocking part is that the United States Justice Department made these arguments. How rare is it, by the way, that a federal agency is arguing that it has less authority under a federal statute? But that's what they were arguing. The Supreme Court said otherwise. It said these removals are mandatory. And it said that states can choose to send a letter to someone merely because they haven't voted in a couple of years.
Well, so we're in the era of technology here. How is it that when somebody moves across state lines, you know, I could understand maybe there's some ambiguity there when somebody moves from one county to the next or out of jurisdiction type thing. But we're in the era of technology. How is it that when somebody registers in another state after they've moved, how is that not automatically flagged in the previous state? You would think that they would have some kind of setup for that.
Well, listen, before the NVRA, before that law was passed in 1993, states were entirely in charge of this process of registration, of saying a registration was out of date, of figuring out when someone had died or moved. Okay, and they had various standards for doing so. And in some states, you had to register every election. Every single time you intended to vote in the future, you had to register. The NVRA comes in and it does away with that. Okay, now it's no longer you're presumptively removed. Now it's you're presumptively kept on the rolls until certain events occur. Okay, that's fine, but that's the federal government getting into the business of monitoring how states register and remove registrations. Okay, and so we're in a sort of uncomfortable halfway house. The federal government is empowered under the U.S. Constitution to be even more involved in that process. And yes, states should be federally required to compare their voter rolls to each other, to come up with, you know, a reasonable notion of who may have moved. Now, there are private companies that can help you with that. But yes, that ought to be federal law. We're sort of moving into federal control.
Yeah. Well,
which normally I would oppose, but here it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. In this case, it certainly would to certainly notify the other states that, hey, we've got one of your former voters here. All right. Everyone stay with us. It's time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Bob Popper. He's senior attorney for Judicial Watch, and we're going to be digging into that lawsuit they filed against Oregon. And welcome back. We're talking to Bob Popper today. He is a senior attorney with Judicial Watch and directs their voting integrity efforts. They currently have a lawsuit against the state of Oregon demanding they clean up their voter rolls. And Bob, before we get to that lawsuit, though, there's one question I really wanted to ask. Mm-hmm. Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton has said dirty voter rolls can mean dirty elections. Well, we are talking about people that move across state lines. Have you guys ever uncovered evidence of bad rolls that where some people are allegedly voting in that state that should not have voted?
Well, other people have. I mean, states will issue various reports. And if you think about it, there's a couple ways this could happen. Okay, let's say that you've rented a home in a vacation space, all right? And so you have a second home, and your son comes, and your son is skiing in the area, whatever there is, whitewater rafting. Okay, and a registration comes through the mail, and he knows that the son knows you're not going to be there. The son can vote it, mail it in, depending on the state. If you live close to a border and you have fraudulent intent, you can vote in both places with mail-in ballots. You can mail one back and vote in the other place. I mean, you know, there's double voting. There's just using bad registrations to vote someone else's ballot, you know, someone who may not ever show up to the polls. There's using the registrations of people you know are incapacitated because they're very old. I mean, if you have a bad registration, a lot of bad things can happen. And, you know, it's not fixed, even if registrations are not mailed to voters who haven't voted in a while. That sometimes happens. But that doesn't fix it. You can still, on election day, vote what we call an inactive registration. That's federal law. You can show up and you can say, it shouldn't be inactive. I'm here. I want to vote. And they have to let you. Okay. But there are a couple of ways that it could go terribly wrong. Double voting is not wildly penalized in this country. My favorite example comes from, I believe it was Vermont law, said that the penalty for double voting was $200 fine. And I mentioned that because the penalty in Vermont at the time for selling maple syrup without a license was a $5,000 fine.
Wow.
And a year in prison.
Yeah, with cheating elections, that's fine.
You know where their priorities
lie. Yeah, well, you know, there was, I think it was the RNC that had uncovered, it was, I forget his name, but there was an attorney that working with them. He had uncovered over 114,000 fraudulent votes being cast in Michigan in 2024. One person had voted 29 times in different locations around Michigan. So this sort of thing does absolutely happen. So in July, you guys had warned Oregon of your intent to sue, to give them a chance to start cleaning up the voter rolls on their own, and they did not. However, they did manage to find a bunch of illegal immigrants that had magically appeared on our voter rolls, even though they said that that could never happen. And then October 23rd, that's when you guys did, in fact, sue Oregon to force the state to clean up
right.
its voter rolls. So talk to us about this lawsuit and what exactly are you guys hoping to accomplish here?
Well, we're hoping to accomplish what we've accomplished by settlement in New York City, okay, which is that Oregon's voter rolls, to our eyes, and I think by Oregon's own admission, are something of a mess. There are too many old, outdated registrations. And, you know, even these registrations can be voted on election day. I can't emphasize that enough. And so they need to be updated, which in many cases means removed. Now, we took the data that Oregon sent to a federal agency. It's called the Election Assistance Commission. And by law, they are required to submit a report to Congress every 2 years on enforcement of the list maintenance provisions of the Motor Voter Act. Or motor voter law. It's not its official name. It's its unofficial name, and it's the motor voter law.
Mm-hmm.
They sent data to the federal government indicating that 19 Oregon counties removed zero registrations on account of people having moved out of county in a 2 year period, and that 11 other Oregon counties reported removing just handfuls of registrations, 11 or fewer. And these 29 counties together, and this is what they're telling the federal government. I didn't discover this or make this up or find it somewhere.
Right.
Okay. So those 29 counties contain 2.4 million registrations. And in 2.4 million registrations, they removed a total of 36 for having moved out of the county without having told the state.
Wow.
Now, just to give you an idea, the mobility rate in Oregon, according to the most recent census data, is 14% move per year. Okay.
Yeah,
that number should be
a little bit of a problem there.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's a huge problem. And so what are we trying to do? How about you remove 100,000, couple hundred thousand registrations? That, you know, are set to be removed. If the letters, notice letters that are referred to haven't been sent, how about you send them?
Yeah.
Now, we arranged something of a similar settlement, for example, in Los Angeles County, where we had the state and the county of Los Angeles send 1.6 million registration notices. These are address confirmation letters to various voters. Ultimately, after 4 years, 1.2 million registrants were removed from Los Angeles County's voter roll.
Wow.
Okay, so what are we looking to do? That.
So you had kind of touched on this earlier about the mail-in voting. With bad voter rolls like what Oregon has, and they sound astonishingly horribly bad, does Oregon's all mail-in ballot situation, does that make things even worse or more apt for cheating?
Well, it makes things more dangerous and more apt for cheating, I guess, is the short answer. Because, you know, we refer back often to something called the Carter-Baker Commission. That's President Carter and yes. I believe James Baker. Mm-hmm. And that report was as bipartisan as it gets. And it indicated that absentee ballots are more prone to cheating. And there's a common sense to this, because impersonation fraud is when you go to the polls and you say you're someone you're not. And, you know, bear in mind, I think it's 15 states right now, don't require any photo ID to vote.
Yes. And Kamala okay, won every single one of those in the 2024 election. It's pretty astonishing. Okay, it is time for a break. Everyone stay with us. We'll wrap up with Bob Popper. He is a senior attorney with Judicial Watch. We're talking about Oregon's voter rolls that need to be cleaned up. Stay with us. Back on our final segment now here on the Ask Bob Radio Show, we've been talking with Bob Popper. He is a senior attorney for Judicial Watch and runs their election integrity unit there. And I had to kind of interrupt you in that last one because we were approaching a break there. And I had asked you whether or not mail-in ballots were more prone to fraud. Can you go ahead and finish your thoughts on that?
Well, sure. What I was pointing out was that the Carter-Baker Commission concluded in 2005 exactly what you're suggesting, that is true. If you think about it, the reasons are fairly obvious. If you're going to lie about who you are and go in person and vote at the polls, it takes some guts, right? Your person is there. You can be seized if you're caught, right? But it doesn't take any courage to drop something in the mail that you filled out without your real name on it.
Hmm.
And so it's more likely, it's more dangerous. Yes.
So in terms of Oregon, and you've got this lawsuit now, well, first of all, have they given you any response? Because this is now a couple of weeks, 3 weeks almost, after you guys had filed that.
No, they've given us a schedule for the response. And, you know, the time for the response is proceeding normally.
Okay. So if they say no, you know, this goes to trial and they basically say, no, we're just not going to clean these up. Is there any kind of enforcement at that point to say, no, absolutely, you have to follow
well,
through?
Well, yes, we can get a court order. We can get a settlement. We can get an enforceable settlement, a consent decree. Yes, there are options. I mean, the courts are not without weapons to make something happen if there's been a violation. So absolutely. And I mean, we have consent decrees with some states. We have settlement agreements with some states. And if we have to get a judgment, which is they never, ever agree to clean their voter rolls, we'll do that. And then the entire court order is enforceable against their will. But I will tell you that most states at a certain point concede that, look, we just haven't been doing this because we didn't want to. Yes, it's the right thing to do. We'll do it. As long as we can stay away from an ideological commitment to not cleaning the voter rolls, which we've seen. I mean, I saw this at the Department of Justice. The Deputy Assistant Attorney General told a room full of people that I was in when I worked in the voting section, told us that she, quote, didn't care about the NVRA.
Wow.
And it was no idle threat. I mean, they brought no lawsuit.
Well, you know, the left loves to say that, you know, especially when they're targeting conservatives and President Trump, they love to say nobody's above the law. Well, shouldn't that apply to states?
That's our motto. But yes, it should. It should apply to state officials. And, you know, I think the ideological components of state agencies and even of federal agencies sooner or later are overridden by the grown-ups in the room. Hmm. I mean, it's a sensible law. It's, you know, logical. It's much more forgiving than the old state laws used to be. It's years. And frankly, if you're removed from the voter rolls, even incorrectly, it's not hard to re-sign up.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not hard to register. In fact, some states allow you to do it online, and, you know, there's ways to do it that are not difficult for people. So anyway, I think that the sheer sense of the law makes enforcement likely in the long term. I certainly am open to any sort of deal that'll make it happen. And if there's no deal, I'm certainly open to that.
Hmm. Well, we've had two fairly recent election integrity lawsuits, but they were filed in state courts first. I know the Ninth Circuit had ruled against it, but you guys have filed in federal courts, though, correct?
That's right.
Okay. So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say, I just think that's really going to improve your chances here, because practically every judge that would have heard this otherwise, they're all Democrats. Certainly on the Supreme Court, we've had 20-some years of judicial appointments all by Democrats. Mm. So,
well, look, you know, I think there's a more universal appeal to enforcing voter list maintenance. It's not a crazy theory. It's not, you know, no one's seeking to restrict access. I mean, you know, what we found in California was that many people on the list of people who may have moved were actually dead. All right, so you're not disenfranchising anyone. Right. This law has been around for 30 years. States and the federal government ought to know by now and ought to know how to enforce it.
Yeah, exactly. So in the time that we have left here, and unfortunately, we don't have a minute here with you. Do you think that because, you know, with 2024, Trump winning the popular vote, now you've got Democrats being the election deniers and saying that he must have cheated somehow. Do you think this offers a chance for both left and right to finally come together and say, let's get some fair, honest, and secure elections?
You would hope so. I mean, I don't know. I'm terrible at political prognosticating. I'm terrible at polls. I'm terrible at predicting what judges will do, which you wouldn't think for a lawyer. You know, so I don't know, but it would seem to be logical. There would be a way to rationalize this system that both sides could, you know, work from and accomplish a deal. Yeah. But this law needs to be made more universal.
Yes, it does. I agree. So unfortunately, we are up against the clock. Bob Popper, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
It was great to be here anytime.
Most of 2024 was about getting the presidency back. 2026 will be about not losing the support that he already has. Otherwise, we'll be right back to 2018 and impeachments will be on the way. You can bet that the Democrats will be pouring everything they can into retaking the House. And that includes convincing squishy Republicans in both the House and Senate to sabotage Trump to stop his agenda from being a success, which we all know it can be. So when Trump says we need to hold the government accountable, that means all of it, not just bureaucrats. It means the squishy-spined Republicans who are likely to bail when things get tough. We need to make sure the Republicans find their spines or help them find the door. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.